Good evening, this is Gary Kavner here on the right side. I'm here today with my friend and colleague, Michael Dwyer. Dublin City Council has wrote to the Irish government asking them to repatriate the body of James Joyce, a story I want to talk about because I just want to remind people James Joyce hated Ireland. I mean, he did. People say, oh, there was a complicated relationship. No, he hated Ireland. Well, more particularly the people in Ireland, particularly Yeats.
Well, yeah.
And then I want to talk about, we want to talk about A New Irish Time, because you're important, Michael.
I know, I'm very important.
You're a person.
I'm a little
And don't person. Let anyone put you down. But anyway, yes, we want to talk about A New Irish Times poll that says that it was asking voters about climate change and what they would do to avoid climate change. But we also want to talk a bit more generally about the green movement and its approach to technology, both in relation to food production, energy, and sort of what's helped people previously in dealing with these sort of issues, and if the green kind of movement actually supports what we know has worked previously or not.
Let them eat cake. That's what the green movement says.
Well, they certainly won't be able to eat rice.
No.
Well, maybe as long as it's not golden.
No golden rice.
So, Michael, I suppose we might as well start with James Joyce. I think there's two parts of this story. One is Ireland has this weird hang-up on a man who didn't even like Ireland. But then, considering all of his work references Ireland, so did he. Why are Dublin City Council doing this, though? Do they not have some homes to build? Or more aptly, do they now have some homes that they can stop from being built?
There is a ghoulish quality to this particular suggestion. And if somebody wanted to say, well, let's build some kind of monument to Joyce, let's put up a nice bronze statue to Joyce somewhere.
And we have enough statues to Joyce.
I have a friend who has a mold ready made for a statue he made many years ago. Never got to sell it. So if they are interested and they're listening, you contact us here, and I can put you in the way of a very nice statue. Or they could have done, I don't named a building or a street. There's no Joyce Street in Dublin, is there? In fact, when I come to think of it, there's no Yates Street or Kavanagh Street. Why is that? Why don't we name streets and things about after artists? In my own metropolis of Gorry, we actually have named recently a street after a prominent local artist, the Paul Funge Boulevard, which I think is a very fine name for a street, but it might give people who are not from the town an rather unfortunate expectation what they might find on Paul Funge Boulevard. It's not exactly Unter den Linden. There are no with little French coffee shops and the shade of the trees. But for some reason, I think it would be a much more sensible thing to pick a bridge in Dublin and call it after. Why would you want to dig up the man's body? Also, are they just bringing him home and leaving his wife and kids there? He's buried in Zurich, yes?
Yeah, he's buried in Zurich with his wife, Nora, and his children.
So what are they going to do? Leave Nora and the kids behind? That seems rather cruel. Where are they going to bury them here?
I mean, quite amusing if they only took his body and left his wife and children in Zurich.
You know, it would certainly, I suppose, kind of justify Joyce's position on the nature of the unevolved nature of the morality of the Irish and Irish politicians. If it comes to that, is there an estate to which one would have to go?
I think his grandson is still alive.
So you'd ask him.
So you'd have to get him to sign off on it. And considering that the Irish government didn't send a delegation when Joyce died, might be a bit of a difficult one.
Joyce died in 1941. So point number one, there was a world war going on in Europe at the time. Point number
still
two,
art, Michael. Though there was still art.
It was still art. No, point number two, the president, the Taoiseach at the time was De Valera. Now, while Dev was a man much in sympathy with the arts and the art. Not, I think, the art and the artists of James Joyce. It would be wildly improbable to imagine any member of that Fianna Fáil government going out to stand at the graveside of whatever kind of service attended the obsequies of James Joyce.
Do you think this would go... Do you remember when we moved Yeats bones?
Yes.
And it turned out they weren't Yeats?
Well, yeah, it was fortunate.
David Norris was asked what he thought about this, and he spent years trying to get Joyce repatriated for some reason. And that was his response. I mean, we tried, didn't work. And when we dug up Yeats, they got the wrong person.
If it was going to be a la Yeats, the grave of Yeats under the tree beside the church in Drumcliff under the shadow of Ben Bulbin is very, very lovely, very beautiful. And does, and this is, of course, the most important thing, Gary, brings loads of tourists.
Well, I think that might be one of the reasons the Swiss don't want us to move him.
That seems unlikely to me, Gary. I mean, I've never heard that the Swiss were ever particularly attached to money. I mean, it's not something that is very highly valued in their culture, I don't think.
All I can think of now is the phrase Nazi gold.
Exactly. Nobody except the Swiss would have been so naive and not bothered about the whole thing as to accept large amounts of gold from these people. And art and currency from these people, never thinking for a moment, gosh, I wonder where this came from.
I wonder if this came from all those people they shot.
Yes.
Those are the kind of questions a Swiss banker doesn't ask himself. No. Certainly not at that time. But yes, yeah, so there's two things here. One, this city councils in Ireland and county councils, particularly Dublin City Council, have this weird thing of, we're just going to do something totally unrelated to our job. Like, we're going to fly the Palestinian flag.
Yeah.
And why? Like, your job is, you're not a lower house of parliament. But then again, pretty much the only other thing I can think that they do is set rates and refuse planning permission, thereby making the housing crisis much worse, so that their politicians can then go, well, this is terrible.
And also that politicians then and other people can go on and make money by corrupting the system, because the system became so incredibly blocked up that the only way to negotiate around it was through corrupt payments. Indeed, there is a tremendous fondness for the local governments of Ireland, and I suspect probably outside of Ireland, to attempt to act ultra vires. My personal favourite for many years was, I think this sign is still up, because I think the rule is still in vigour. As you enter the Wexford town, or the part of Wexford town governed by Wexford Corporation, you will be informed that Wexford is a nuclear-free zone, Gary.
I think they've got the right idea, actually. I think they're right to start saying that we should repatriate people. But I actually have a better idea of who they should repatriate. Repatriate?
Yeah. Exactly.
Repatriation, but into a bog.
Lisa Smith?
No, and this is someone who's currently on the move as well, so he's looking for a new home.
All right.
Franco.
Franco's on the move?
Franco, the Spanish parliament, have voted to dig him out of his grave because it's too nice.
Well, apparently.
It is very, a fabulous grave. Nice.
But Franco was responsible for the creation of the valley and of the basilica and of the mausoleum. No, Franco
and
several
the mausoleum.
Thousand other, you know, slave labour, political prisoner people.
You don't get a temple like that without some slave labour.
No, you don't.
But the Spanish Supreme Court has said moving him, and it's a political problem for him because his tomb becomes sort of a tourist attraction. So we'll just bury it in Ireland.
Hmm.
We'll bury him in Yeats' grave instead of the person who we put there. We'll just hoof him out onto the road.
Bury Franco in Yeats's grave.
Yeah, and don't explain the rationale. It makes at least as much sense as most of the motions Dublin City Council passes. It is as relevant to what they should be doing.
Okay, I'll accept that.
Also, it would be deeply amusing.
But my concern here, you know, and this is for Franco, obviously. Would Franco be happy being buried in, shall we say, ground run by our separated brethren? You know, Franco was a fairly serious Catholic. I can't imagine that his spirit...
Well, we could consecrate the land. It'll be fine. You're creating problems, Michael, where there don't need to be problems.
Yes, you should be looking for solutions. There are many graveyards around the country which are mixed use, shall we say. They are ecumenical. You could get a bishop in there, bish-bash, bit of holy water, away you go. You could have the ground.
I mean, we could, you know, bring over some of his friends from the mausoleum as well. We already have that German war cemetery up near Glendalough.
We do. It's very pretty. very lovely.
It is, and if you go there, if the listener has never been there, if you go up there at the right time of year, the river is really high in iron, so the river will occasionally run kind of blood red, which when you're looking at a war cemetery is exactly what you want. It has a river going through one side of it.
That's exactly what you want, particularly if you're one of those people that I've heard about who go up to that part of the Wicklow Mountains.
Who might be interested in a German war cemetery from the World Wars.
And psychobilin, because that also grows locally.
I ran into that place randomly. I was walking by. We'd gotten off the wrong place to walk to Grand Lough, and we stopped. And I was the cemetery part of it is written in German. And I was just trying, looking at it, and all I could see is Krieg. And I was like, that's weird. That's German.
That's war.
It's war. Yeah. I'm going to pop in here and see what this is.
So, getting back to James, do you have some kind of objection to the fact that James, because James had some complicated feelings about the homeland?
No, I just think that it's not Dublin City Council's job, and frankly, I think Joyce was a hack, so...
Well, we should agree to disagree.
I'm not terribly moved to repatriate him.
I think Joyce was... A genius and an incredible writer.
That makes it worse, though.
Got lost up his own fundament when he went down the road of Finnegan's Wake.
Joyce is actually a genius, and that's what he did with his life. That's just disappointing.
I think the...
Whereas at least mine, we can say he was trying.
Yeah, he was trying. He did the best he could with what he got, in fairness. Whereas I think if you read... there is maybe a sad condemnation, I don't know. I know that there is a vast industry of scholars around the Joyce enterprise. I think that Joyce is regarded as the progenitor or whatever of the modernist novel.
He is. He's considered one of the finest novelists in the world by people who've never read him.
However, if you read Ulysses and then you attempt to read Finnegan's Wake, is one of those books you never see people finishing. You always see them starting. It's just one of those things. And then you read his collection of short stories, particularly The Dead. I can't help but feel that the unbiased, the person who doesn't have any skin in the game financially will admit that the Dead is an absolute jewel.
The Dead is an excellent story.
Gorgeous piece of writing. And that somehow Finnegan's Wake is a bit of a disappointment after it. But there you go. Listen, if they want to bring him over, I cannot imagine the burghers of Zurich will ever give him up. But should they give him up, we could, bring him over. We'll find some place for him. In a suitably touristy area in Dublin. St. Auden's maybe, throw him down. With the mummies. But until that day, I think, yes, we can just expect. It's just one more of those things that comes out of the Dublin City Council, which is basically there to generate noise and not anything else.
So on the point of generating noise and not anything else, the Irish Times has a new poll on climate change.
Yes.
And it says that climate change is the most serious issue for a majority of voters.
Yep.
Now, before I move on, I will give my initial reaction to that horseshit. Grade A to Z horseshit. Irish voters. They do not vote on climate change. They will vote on climate change to exactly the point it inconveniences them in any way.
Does it give any indication of intensity?
No, it doesn't. But it also, here's the opening statement. A majority of voters believe climate change is the most serious issue facing the world, but they're not convinced about carbon tax increases, and a substantial minority are sceptical about the urgency of the problem. And then when you go into it, you find that, 55% agree climate change is the most serious issue facing the world, 36% disagree. 54% say they're prepared to reduce their standard of living to combat climate change. When you ask them if they'll pay more for fuels, specifically for fuels, 48% say no, which means there's crossover with the people who say they will reduce their standard of living.
Right.
If you ask them, should the government spend money on climate change instead of public service, 56% say no. And here's the thing. Money has to come from somewhere. And their living standards will have to go down. And there will have to be a reduction in public services. So, that horse doesn't run.
Listen, we know, for example, that if you survey people on a very shallow level about the health service, that the vast majority of people say they're very concerned about the health service and that they think that it's an awful state. But then if you actually poll them on the question of how their personal experience was, that nine out of 10 people, these figures were last 6-7 years old, 9 out of 10 people found their own personal experience of the health service was positive. And then if you ask them on intensity, as in how likely was this to be the issue that decided their vote in at a positions of 1 to 10, where would they position it as an issue of importance? They put it around 6. Almost nobody, historically, voted on the basis of the health service. Now, I think that may be about to change. maybe about to see an absolute collapse in the health service in the country in the next 3 or 4 years, and then it would actually become so acutely bad that people might actually vote on it. Historically, what people vote on in this country is the economy, stupid, which is what people in other countries vote on. It's unemployment, it's inflation, the ability or the inability to buy yourself a house, what you're paying for rent. It's the economy, stupid. Now, everything we know about the policies that have been proposed for the management of the climate crisis insofar as it exists tell us that those policies are going to have a very negative impact on the economy and on our quality of life. So it's hard to square the circle here, Gary.
It is also interesting that 33% say they're not worried about climate change.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe they're kind of, some people are just more relaxed about stuff. You know, it'll happen. If it happens, it happens.
When you actually, the actual results to the government should spend more money on tackling climate change and less money on public services. 26% of people agreed with that.
Okay.
So there's a limited amount of money here.
Yes.
So I don't get how 54% of people say that they're willing to reduce their standard of living, but only 26% of people said yes to we'll take a reduction in public services.
I mean, you're asking this as a serious question? I mean, really? Well, for a start, you're assuming that people can add up, and they can't. You're also assuming that people can't hold two contradictory opinions at the same time, which they do. In fact, it's almost the hallmark of the modern voter, is that he holds a multiplicity of views which are at conflict with each other, and he holds them all with the same degree of certainty and passion. When it actually comes to putting the pencil to paper, do I have a job? Am I likely to have a job? How secure is it? Am I going to have more money or less money if this crowd get back in again? These are the questions that will occur.
Oh, and the thing about this is this polling was done Friday and Sunday of last week, just after the Extinction Rebellion protests.
Right.
So it's probably higher than it would normally be. But I did like the Irish Times headline on one of it. One of the pieces they wrote about this. It's results reveal majority grasp gravity of situation.
Grasp crisis. Gravity.
Sorry.
They grasp the gravity. Somebody's having a bit of an alliterative fun there.
All of it, this is a fairly standard rule.
I mean, would you not say that in the last 18 months, and particularly in the last 6 months, we have had more solid, continuous, green policy propaganda than we've seen at any stage in the last 20 years? I mean, we've had it every so often, but in the last 18 months, it's become a consistent theme. It's in the papers. There's a story almost every day in the papers about it. There's something coming out of the Dáil every other week about it. It is now a constant drumbeat. And so it's not surprising that people haven't, to some extent, absorbed it. What is surprising is that they have so far managed to resist the siren call of actual policy change.
I don't think that's surprising at all. Because for all the selfishness of the voter. Yeah. Also the fact that, so let's say you're really into this and you're absolutely willing to just gut your own quality of life for it. At some point, you're going to do something like look at how much of global pollution is caused by Ireland.
Right.
And it's going to be very hard to take that and then go, that's worth destroying my quality of life for.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen the estimates for how much the climate would reduce by if Western Europe didn't exist? As in just gone.
Tiny fractions.
It would push back by 2100 the rate of climate change by a year.
Yeah, we've talked about this before. If we look at the Paris Climate Accord and we're looking at their assessment, their predictions of future climate change, and on the, I would point out always that every single one of the models that has been used in the past has failed dramatically, has been wildly pessimistic, and has simply not come up to scratch when producing. So there should be a very large caveat emptor when people come along with these doomsday scenarios. But maybe one of these days they'll be right. But the Paris Accord agreed that even if everybody within the Accord did everything they were supposed to do, they would succeed in reducing the heating by 0.9 of a degree. To achieve that would be over $1 trillion.
I think this is, I mean, the things that Extinction Rebellion are talking about are nonsense, as we saw when their own spokesperson ended up on the Andrew Neil show and had to accept that there was no science behind what they were saying, but as the phrase was, alarmist language works, which is not a great sign if you're saying, well, we need people to be afraid. But if they, let's ignore most of the stuff they say about billions dying and stuff like that, because that's just horseshit, as they themselves would accept. If their maths is right on anything else, it's going to be a question of adaption. Yes. It's not a question of stopping it.
No.
Because when you're looking at the actual production of pollution and CO2, it's almost all coming from rapidly industrializing countries. And considering industrialization is the strongest drive of prosperity, and those countries are primarily democracies, or not democracies, but care about the feelings of their people, they're not going to accept a stop on that. And they will make the very good argument that the West industrialized, and so they should have the ability to do so, and it's not their fault. And that's pretty unchangeable. So it's one of the major problems with Extinction Rebellion. If they're right, the only actual solution is adaption and technological change. And the thing that they're against is adaption and technological change.
Exactly. That's so we are wasting so much time talking about changing climate change and reducing CO2 to the point where we can stop heating if heating is occurring, rather than saying, listen, if any of this stuff is right, we're not going to do that. We're going to maybe slow down the process. We're going to reduce the quantity. We're going to reduce the speed at which it happens. We have to be looking now at those technologies and those policies which are going to help us to adapt, to live and to prosper in the new paradigm, the new climactic paradigm. We are being actively told, no, we are not interested in adaption. We're not interested in new technologies. We're not interested, what was the phrase from that group?
No techno fixes.
Because the reality is that these people actually don't care about that much. About the.
There was a little bit of a scandal there involving Niall Boylan, the talk show host on Classic. He went on, I think it was the show with Ivan Yates and Matt Cooper, and he held up a diagram which he said was natural disasters, and he said they were falling. And it turned out that wasn't what the diagram was. It was actually deaths caused by natural disasters have fallen spectacularly.
Yes.
And he kind of got excoriated for it, and I saw it, and I sort of went, well, it's a fairly easy mistake to make, particularly on live TV, to talk about rates of national disasters versus deaths from natural disasters. Deaths have fallen spectacularly because we have more money, so it's a lot easier to build for these things.
Absolutely. I think that actually the point he's making, or the point that he wanted to make, actually would have been a perfectly decent and important point to make. While the number of natural disasters may not have declined, our capacity to deal with them has massively improved.
And that's like, if these guys are right, this is the game in town for actual climate change.
Yeah.
Because none of their reduction measures will do anything at all.
Simply because
of the scale of the issue and the countries involved. China and India between them are just polluting on an incredible scale. And they go, well, yes, but per capita, America is number one. And you go, yes, but China has three times as many people as America. And there's this weird sort of thing of per capita, when that does not matter in this equation. This is a raw numbers game.
Also, actually, a lot of the time, even the per capita numbers are actually misleading. They don't actually tell you what they purport to tell you. Anyway, I think that I'm personally confident. I mean, if we look, for example, simple things like carbon capture, which it was 10, 15 years ago, people were starting to get into the idea we can simply take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and put it into something historic. It was enormously expensive, and it was, everybody said, no, it can't be done. We're now down to a point where it's getting close to being self-financing, that the and the technologies will get better.
It's also a weird thing for any sort of naturalist group to do. It reminds me of when people will say, like, someone will hunt an animal and they'll shoot it, and people will say, well, you know, try and do that with your hands, give it a fair shot. And all I can ever think is that certain animals have claws, certain animals have teeth, they have heightened senses of smell. That is their natural advantage in the environment. Man's natural advantage has always been teamwork and tools. The natural response to any solution or to any issue is tool-based. It is.
When man comes up against something like a grizzly bear or a lion or a tiger, we are a squidgy, soft bag of stuff which they can open up very easily. We can't run as fast as them if we want to get away. We can't jump as far, and we can't climb as well. Maybe we can swim better than some, but basically, if it's a straight-up physical contest, one-on-one, you're not going to win with a grizzly bear or with a tiger or with an African lion. The way that we have won is by acting cooperatively in groups and by thinking up clever schemes. That's how we get on. That's what we do. And then we haven't stopped doing that, and we will.
I've read through a lot of Extinction Rebellion's platforms, and it is way, way more wide-ranging and way worse than I think people realise, particularly the sort of bring back the French Revolution.
Yeah.
That was not a great one. But I do suspect that they, like a lot of the deep green movement, in a moment of honesty, would simply go, there are actually just too many people.
Oh, way too many.
And we're not going to die, but someone here has to die in great numbers. And that will fix the problem.
Some of them will be honest and put a number out there. I mean, I saw one number. I mean, one group was saying 500 million, another said a billion. And on the other hand, I don't know, did you see Elon Musk was on telly the other day? Well, on telly, he was on video the other day, talking about the fact that actually we don't have a problem with the overall population, but we are facing into a population crisis.
Yes, but I think those are very different views of humanity. But it reminds me of, but when I was growing up, there were constant refrains in Africa for starvation and drought relief.
Yes.
Constant charitable refrains. And they've largely stopped now. And it hasn't been because everyone there lives a solid green life.
No.
It's because of technological advances in food production.
Well, technology, yeah, it's to a degree. I mean, the single biggest, I would say tech advances have been important. I mean, but the tech advances haven't had to be necessarily particularly fancy. Roads, proper asphalted roads, would one of the biggest advances in Africa when it comes to dealing with starvation, because one of the problems historically was you couldn't get food. I mean, there has never been a problem in the modern world with food production, Gary. There's never been a point where we have gone into negative food. We've always had surplus food. The problem has been getting food. So famines have tended to occur when you get, okay, failure of crops with drought, for example, in Ethiopia, but mixed in with that, a failure of the civil systems because of war. Civil war or war of another kind. But sometimes.
It's actually something I'd forgotten there about the green movement. Do you remember Greenpeace and the golden rice issue?
Yes.
So for the listener, golden rice is a genetically engineered type of rice, which is a weird thing to say because any foodstuff that's been curated for humans over generations is effectively genetically engineered.
And rice, most certainly, has been intensively changed the last 5,000 years.
And it was designed to be rich in vitamins, particularly, I think, vitamin A or a precursor to vitamin A, because vitamin A deficiency kills hundreds of thousands of children a year.
Mm-hmm.
It can also cause, if you remember a couple of years ago, all of the ads for childhood blindness in Africa,
yeah.
A lot of that was vitamin A deficiency. Greenpeace basically tried to stop its adoption in Africa, and in a couple of countries, I believe, successfully did so. They would go to governments and tell them that they shouldn't adopt this because it was a genetically engineered rice. And Greenpeace's anti-nuclear stance really, really kind of epitomized the green movement. We don't really care if people die, and we don't really care if we've scuttled a solution. I mean, these are people who've spent years campaigning against climate change and have demonized nuclear to the extent it's just politically not a runner. And they will also stop something which is designed to stop childhood blindness and hundreds of thousands of children dying because it goes against their ideology. They now say that, well, it's not our fault. Golden Rice failed. We merely brought up concerns about it. But they lobbied very, very heavily to African governments to keep this out. They're
deeply suspicious of any kind of innovation. I mean, probably when do you remember Norman Borlaug? He introduced a dwarf wheat variety into India, which meant that whereas previously during the storm seasons, the wheat could get knocked over and then it would die. This smaller variety was much more resistant and increased production of food across India. India is now net plus in its food bank. That kind of thing has become increasingly difficult at a PR level, because if you sit down and listen to people talk about genetically modified organisms, it is bizarre what they think is actually going on and what's happening. Again, it's kind of comic and it's kind of scary. That it's like that if you have milk from a genetically modified cow, that somehow this ingesting the milk will affect you in some way that you will become like the cow. If that was the case, I mean, why don't we all become tomatoes when we eat tomatoes? I don't know. The level of scientific ignorance about this is incredible. But it is being pushed, and it's being pushed with emotive language. These are sterile, and they're being pushed because they're not like the traditional seeds that traditional farmers have, which they can use every year. Except that's fine, but these traditional seeds produce a fraction of what the others do. And very often they don't have the seeds for the following year to plant the crop again, because they had to eat them. Because there was either a total crop failure or the actual crop came in was so minuscule to feed the family that to grind up the seed crop.
This current thing kind of reminds me of the third agricultural revolution,
mm-hmm.
which was a period in the kind of 50s and 60s, and it massively increased agricultural production worldwide. It was a global increase. And other than that happening, we would now be seeing wide-ranging famines across most of Asia. It was an issue of population fixed by technology, which is what we've always seen happen with issues of population. There have been numerous periods in human history where people have went, well, I mean, Malthusian thought
mm-hmm.
that there's just too many people and we're all going to starve. And every time technology has advanced to allow it to continue. And now the green movement sort of goes, well, there can be no technology.
No.
And we go, well, considering that's fixed the problem every other time, I'd say if we stop it, we'll probably kill a great deal of people.
Anyway, this is something that isn't going to go away. And I'm sure we will return to it because they will force us to return to it.
So that has been us. I'm, of course, Gary Kavanagh. I'm here with my friend and colleague.
I've been Michael Dwyer, and we will chat again soon. Have a good week.
All the best.